Hey everyone, my name is Mike Vaughn, and welcome to a new episode of Rotten Cinema, where myself and a very special guest talk about some really fun, good, bad movies. Again, I'm not alone. I have the very talented Stephen C. Miller, director of Margot, which is currently on Paramount Plus, and that movie fucking rolls.
Awesome.
Everybody check it out.
Awesome. Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. This is cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we're, of course, talking about, as you can see, I'm kind of in the festive mood. So we're going to talk some, like, holiday horror. And I think one of my favorite, maybe favorite franchises, or certainly the weirdest horror franchises, like the Silent Night, Deadly Night series. So obviously, you know, you have a big connection with that, and we'll get into that definitely a little bit more later. But what do you think of this series, like, as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, Silent Night, Deadly Night was my first introduction to Christmas horror. I had watched that before I saw Black Christmas, and so I think the reason was because I was probably like 8 at the time, you know, or 9. And we were walking through the video store, and that Silent Night, Deadly Night box cover grabbed my attention so heavily that I was like, wait a minute, there's like Santa's arm hanging out of the chimney with an axe. And, you know, it was one of those things that I was just drawn to. So I was with one of my older cousins at the time, and he was like, you haven't seen this movie? And I was like, I don't even know what this is. So, you know, it was my first introduction to a rated R Christmas horror movie with Silent Night, Deadly Night, and I'm, you know, sort of like floored by it. So after that, it was sort of like, you know, every time there was another one, I had to check them out. But yeah, it's definitely a franchise that stood out to me as one of my first, you know, intros into the genre for Christmas horror.
Nice. Yeah, I would say probably same here. I was trying to think, it was either that or Black Christmas, but it's certainly the one that's it's certainly like my go-to, like, every year. And I kind of came late to the sequels. Like, I had seen the part two, which is basically right. Like most of one.
And a it's little just like one. A montage of the first movie.
last year I did a deep dive of, like, I did all the sequels. I did 2 through 5. And man, those are some bonkers movies.
The crazy thing is they get more bonkers as you go, which is, you know, surprising considering a lot of sequels seem to sort of fizzle out. And I felt like the Silent Night, Deadly Night franchise, they keep getting more ridiculous. The third one was probably one of my more favorite of the ridiculous sequels. Yeah, the second one was one of the ones that I, you know, really just took away garbage day from because it was so crazy.
It's funny. I think my favorite sequel, like, and there's not one that I super actively dislike. I mean, even part two, you know, it is at least kind of redeemable because it's just so unhinged. But part five,
yeah, I mean, it's so wacky, no doubt. Yeah.
But like part five for me is like,
just... yeah, part five goes completely off the rails too. It's just like ridiculous. I think that and that's what the Silent Night, Deadly Night franchise to me is different than, like, say Black Christmas or anything like that. At least the sequels aren't. Like, Black Christmas for me, I remember watching that being like, this movie, I felt dirty after watching that movie. Like, I was like, this movie is crucial, right? Like, and I think the first Silent Night, Deadly Night tries to be in that vein where it tries very hard to be a shock value. But the sequels tend to be, in my mind, are just more fun than trying to be as hard-hitting as something like Black Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. I think... what's really interesting is, like, when Brian Usna started working on the series, pulling up my notes here. I know he did part, he directed part four and maybe wrote part five.
Yeah, I know he directed four. I didn't know he did five.
Well, I think, let me just double check, but I know that he did, like, he wrote one of them. He didn't direct it, but he, like, wrote it. I think, yeah, like, maybe, let me see. I just want to, like, double check. Yeah, so it was co-written by Brian Usna, and it also, it has effects by Screamin' Mad George, so it very much has that early kind of Empire feel.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, and gosh, like I said, five is my favorite because, and it's kind of weird because this is like weirdly a year for like Pinocchio movies.
Right. Yeah.
And
two of them.
Yeah. And what's kind of wild is like, part five is kind of like a sort of Pinocchio slash maybe a little bit of like Shelley's Frankenstein sort of thrown in there. And I really like how this was fun rewatching this because I got the Vestron Blu-ray, which is really awesome. And Yasha picked that up. But
is that the three pack? Is that the one that came with three, four, and five?
Yeah. Yeah. And now I feel like I'm on the Video Attic, but it's awesome. It's loaded with extras. It's like hella cheap right now. Cheap and easy. That's me. But yeah, it really feels like you're kind of watching a nightmare. Like, and I know that's kind of maybe a little cliche to say, but I'm sure you can probably speak to this as a film maker yourself, but like, it's very hard to like tap into that. Like, it feels just like you're watching someone's dream. Like, it's so surreal at times where it's like, it's just like a stream of consciousness. It's not really.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. I mean, it really is hard to tap into that even as a filmmaker, because that stream of consciousness, you're never really quite sure if that's coming across on screen, because you've watched it so many times. And I know that from just experience on some of my films that have had even flashbacks in general that are trying to give that sort of feel. And it's a difficult process to get right. And I think for me, part five almost feels like the whole movie feels like that. It feels like it's just, you know, a conscious dream. And I think what they do with that, to me, is some pretty wild filmmaking. Is a really kind of a throwback to some of the 90s filmmaking. I mean, I think, you know, for me, it's like people say 80s all the time, but that one felt like a 90s film to me. You know, it felt very 90s.
Yeah. And while we're on that subject, listen, don't get me wrong, I love 80s horror movies, but I feel like the 90s was a pretty rad time for horror movies. I feel like we
90s was awesome. 90s was so sick. I mean, you got a ton of Puppet Master movies came in the 90s. And then obviously the big dogs like Scream, and I Know What You Did Last Summer. But I mean, the one that I think people look over a lot is Wes Craven's New Nightmare. And like, Wes Craven's New Nightmare to me was quintessential my like high school movie. Like, I was in ninth grade, that movie hit me, and I was like, this is better than any nightmare film I've ever seen. You know what I mean? Like, I was into that movie. Like, and it's pre-Scream, right? It was doing like, you know, almost that sort of vibe before Scream, before he did it. And so, yeah, that movie to me gets very looked over as one of the ones that I think is crucial for the 90s.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I definitely feel like New Nightmare definitely doesn't get the props that it does. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's such an interesting way to kind of deconstruct it. Like, again, it would make a very good companion piece with Scream because it's sort of deconstructing it in a different way, but you can kind of see where he's playing with that idea. And then it's a little bit more refined when he teams up with Kevin Williamson.
Yeah, he actually, I had a chance to sit with Wes, and I was up for Last House on the Left at one point. And so when I went in to pitch my take on Last House on the Left, and I had to sit with Wes, I think we started talking more about like Nightmare on Elm Street films than I probably should have. I should have been pitching in the movie. But like, we were just like talking and just kept going. And he made that comment. I mean, he said Nightmare was sort of, the new Nightmare was sort of a awakening moment for him for Scream, where he sort of saw Scream while making that movie, and felt like he knew where he wanted to go after that. And I thought that was really interesting. But you could, yeah, you could sort of see that vibe there. But yeah, he was one of those directors that just really understood the genre, understood the audience, and understood how the audience would react to the genre. So, you know, that's rare.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, that's very cool that you got to meet Wes Craven. He's one of those filmmakers that, gosh, I wish I would have got to talk to, not even just an interview, just like hang out with him for a little bit.
Yeah, super smart guy.
Oh yeah, like he was like a professor before he was a filmmaker.
Yeah, he was. I mean, and you can feel that when you're talking to him. He's very intellectual. The way he speaks, the way he carries himself. I mean, the way he talks about movies. You know, you can tell that he deep dives and he understood how to make those movies and to their core and what that does to an audience, even down to specific shot or lens choices. Like, you know, he gets that. So I really dig that kind of filmmaking.
Yeah. It was interesting because I was talking about Scream with a friend of mine, and I was like, he was one of the first, if not only, kind of film, like horror filmmakers that kind of tapped into this really weird, uncomfortable sort of family dynamic. Like, he kind of tapped into that in such a powerful and interesting way. Like you think about 99% of his movies are about sort of the decay and dysfunctional family in some respect. That's interesting. Like, that's kind of a shame that you didn't get to do Last House.
They did that movie so good. They did that movie so well. I thought it's one of my favorite remakes. You know, I thought they did such a great job with it. I mean, it was right on the heels of the Texas Chainsaw like remake, like right after that one came out, and then Hills Have Eyes. So there was a couple really great ones, and I thought that one matched well with those late, you know, 2000, early 2000 remakes. I thought they did a really good job.
Yeah, definitely great. I actually recall seeing that one in the theater, and that was a damn good time with an audience.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, the theater I saw it at the Man's Chinese in L.A., and that theater was rocking. Like, people were having so much fun in that movie. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen movies like that, like where the audience is going so apeshit. I mean, it's rare, but it happens.
Now, have you ever been to a screening of one of your movies and it's been like a really great crowd?
Yeah, the Silent Night, for real, the Silent Night screening, we did two test screenings for the movie before it did a limited theatrical. But the both test screenings that I got to sit in the very back, and I wasn't supposed to be there, but I like sat in the very back just to see, like, people were having an absolute blast with the movie. And it did happen with Margot when we tested Margot, and Margot, people were having a real blast. But Silent Night, for some reason, people were just, you know, hooting and hollering. And I was like, oh, okay, this is cool. People are enjoying and having a good time. And then I got to sneak into a few screenings of it playing around LA and then one in New York. And both times the audience was having a really good time. The only other time one of my movies I felt like that was a big one was when I had a movie called The Aggression Scale that played at South by Southwest. And it was one of the midnight showings at South by Southwest. And that crowd was bananas. They had such a blast with that movie. And so, yeah, it's really cool as a filmmaker to be able to sit with an audience like that. I mean, it really is one of the reasons why you make, in my opinion, why I make movies is I like the communal aspect of a movie theater. And I like being in there with them when I'm showing it, because I get the reaction and I get in real time responses to what I think I did right or what I didn't make work at all. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that sounds awesome. I mean, I imagine that's such a exhilarating feeling, actually watching what you made and like putting it out there. I know.
Yeah, I've been really fortunate. I've been really fortunate in these digital times that, you know, I've made 15 features, and every single feature I've been able to see theatrically with an audience in some capacity. And so even Margot, like I said, it did a few rounds of test screening, so played in some big theaters. So it was before it went to Paramount Plus. So it was like, it was cool. I've been very fortunate to be able to see those theatrically like that, because I know it's different when you're making movies for Netflix and Amazon and all that stuff. You don't always get that opportunity.
Yeah. And I could see like Margot in particular being a lot of fun to watch with an audience, because it is such a fun movie.
Yeah. And the test screenings we showed had zero VFX in it still. So it was like very raw screenings, and people were just losing their minds on certain parts and having a lot of fun with it, even though it was just like blocks of, you know, very primitive VFX work happening. But they, you know, people had a good time, and it was really cool to see that. I mean, and to be honest, it was very surprising that the movie didn't go theatrical, because it was planned to go theatrical almost the entire time until it was like a month before they decided that it wasn't going to go. And then I think they regretted it once Barbarian came out and Smile came out, and these movies that are the same budget as Margot were just getting blowing up. And so, I got a phone call that was like, we probably made a mistake. So it's like, oh, yeah, I get it. But it was fun to see with an audience.
Nice. Now, is it too soon to maybe for fans that want to have it on home video? Is that anything that's...
So I was told that it's not getting a physical release, which is bonkers. It's the first movie I've ever done that will not get a physical Blu-ray. And I guess that doesn't mean it won't happen in the future, but like, as far as I know, because I'm pretty heavy on physical media, as I can see you are, you know, I'm pretty heavy as well. I mean, we can like probably turn my screen around over here and it's all over there. But I was bummed, because I like to collect them. And so when I found out they were saying they don't think it's going to go Blu-ray or DVD, it's a bummer. But I always keep pushing it. So, you know, in another 6 months, I'll push Paramount. Be like, come on, let's get something out for Halloween, or let's try to do this. So I'll push for it as much as I can, because I think most people like to have that physical copy.
Yeah, I feel like we should start a petition, like just get a shitload of signatures, then you can show them we want it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would be cool. Let's start it up.
Hell yeah. I still think about poor Richard and his sloppy browns.
Richard's so great, man. Like, he's a character on the screen, but he's also just a really big character and cool guy off the screen. I mean, we had some really great dinners. We had some great times hanging out just as friends and becoming friends when you make a movie. Not all the time do you get to become friends with the actors, but on Margot specifically, I made it a point to be very involved with the cast and make sure they understood that I was, you know, willing to hang and willing to get down and dirty. If I was asking them to do something crazy, I was willing to be in there with the camera myself if I needed to be in the blood. And there's plenty of times where I was. So I think it was important for them to know that I was willing to get crazy with them. So, but yeah, Richard was a guy that I kind of look to on set often as sort of like a rock of like, hey, get the kids together, get them in order. You know what I mean? And he was very good at sort of wrangling the group. And because most of the movie, it's the group, right? So it's they're not really split off that much. So a lot of the movie is them together. And that as an indie film, that's very difficult when you have six people in a room and you're trying to cover all six angles in the time allotted. It gets crazy.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's really impressive how, you know, you have such a big cast, but you're able to just kind of seamlessly, you know, as you said, get them all together, get them on the same page, you know?
Yeah, it's difficult. I think that kind of comes from, in general, like my movies that I make, they're never given quite a lot of time. But I think it comes to the point where I was an editor by background. I mean, I started out editing music videos and even shooting them, but more editing, and I was really into editing very early on. I thought that's really what I wanted to do, was be full-time editor. It just so happened that, you know, I got out to LA and realized being an editor was fine, but wasn't going to also like initially pay my bills. And it was like, but I want to make a movie, and so I decided to make my own, and it fell into place like that. But originally starting out as an editor, I think that really helps as a director to understand, maybe I don't need A, B, and C, and I only need this, and that'll get the whole scene and tell the story, and it allows, you know, me to sort of cut the movie in my head as I'm shooting.
Yeah, that no, that's really interesting. I mean, that's great because I'm sure that, as you were saying, it helps you, not have a lot of like fat on the bone there. You can just, get what you need, get any pickup
Well,
for you.
I also learned very early on with dealing with studio level movies, as far as like a Lionsgate or like a Paramount, is like the least amount of stuff I can give them to cut, the better. Right? Like I try to shoot it to the point where if they lose something, it's a problem. Right. And so, because I've been in, one of my first or second films, I'm sitting with Lionsgate and them watching it, and it was a very heavy fat director's cut. And then they just had notes galore. It was like, oh my God, like how, they're gonna cut the whole movie out. So I really started to learn that, like, okay, if I shoot really more precise and more exact, that I'm gonna get there and they're not gonna have too much to say, because that's just gonna be the movie. But yeah, it's all sort of planned a little bit.
Nice. Now, I know I alluded to this earlier, but of course, you directed and you mentioned a little bit already, Silent Night, which is awesome. I was actually watching
Yeah.
that again a couple days ago. It's kind of like I definitely put it in with my like must watch Christmas movies.
Awesome.
So how did that come about? Like, how did that project get off the ground?
Well, so I made my first movie in 2005, and it got picked up by the Weinsteins in 2007. So in 2007, I was sort of like a commodity. I was kind of getting shipped around from like studio to studio. They were trying to put me on any remake that you could think of. It was like Children of the Corn at one point. It was like Motel Hell at one point for MGM. And Silent Night, Deadly Night was a project that I really wanted. And at the time, they were trying to get the rights issues settled in. And so me and a friend named Jared Rivet had put together a pitch to go in and pitch the movie. And then it sort of just fell apart. And then in 2010, it came back. And me and my friend named Evan Katz, who is E.L. Katz, who has directed some really cool movies over the past couple of years. But he, me and him went in with a pitch in 2010, and it kind of fizzled out, and they couldn't figure out the rights, and it went away. And then in 2012, I got a call from my buddy Darren Bousman, and Darren was like, Darren went to the same school that I went to, and Darren was like, "Hey man, look, I just did a movie with Richard Saperstein, and they have the right. They finally got the rights for Silent Night, Deadly Night, and I can't do it, and I'm, they asked me to recommend someone, and I'm, of course, you." The first person, and I was like, yeah, I mean, I've been trying to get this movie for felt like eight, a couple years. And so yeah, so I went in, talked to them. They were really excited about it. And there was a script they already had from Jason Rothwell. And I thought the script was really down in my level of things that I thought was really cool. Yeah, that started the process.
That's awesome. And of course, you have like the iconic Malcolm McDowell in it.
Yeah.
That must have been so awesome. Like, what was he like to direct?
Well, first of all, Malcolm's awesome to direct, but like Malcolm wasn't. So Malcolm was staying in the same hotel as me when I was in Winnipeg, and I'm prepping the movie, and I just happened to see Malcolm McDowell sitting at breakfast of my hotel. And I went up to Malcolm and I said, "Malcolm, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm a filmmaker here. I'm making a movie." He's like, "Oh, I'm shooting a movie here as well." And I was like, "Great." I was like, "Why don't you just stay and be in my movie too?" And he was like, he gave me this whole story about no one's really came up and just talked to him other than Zombie. He was like, you remind me of Rob. And like, he was like, "What's the movie?" I was like, "Silent Night, Deadly Night." And he goes, "Oh, I fucking love that movie." And I was like, "All
Nice.
right, well, we're remaking it here." And literally the next day, his team contacted and were like, "He's in." And so it was really just a random circumstance, that he was just happened to be there. And not even really on the list, because we didn't really think he was gettable at that time. And so, yeah, he's one of those guys that just as soon as he lands on set, he commands the set. He's very his presence is very felt, and in a good way. And everyone wants to sort of gravitate to Malcolm, and you sort of have to get everybody moving and keep them working, because they'll talk to him, but Malcolm will just talk, right? Like, if you get Malcolm going, Malcolm will talk. And that's what I love about him. And we had some really great conversations. I mean, I could have sat there and listened to his Kubrick stories, forever, but also his Halloween stories were great. And like, just just the idea that he loves the genre and he loves this sort of style of filmmaking. And this was very different for him. I was like, look, man, I'm asking you to be very zany here. Like, I'm asking you to be kind of like, you know, almost a goofball, but think you're serious. You know, you have to take it very seriously. But the audience has to be like, is this guy mental? Like, what's wrong with this guy? You know what I mean? Like, what's happening? And like, so I think that he played that part really well. And I loved what he did with it.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And I mean, the restraint it would take to not just like, you know, see, for me, I would be like, okay, I have to direct him, but I also just want to talk about Caligula all day.
Yeah, Caligula, definitely. And that's the thing, is he will talk to you about it. Like, if you bring it up, it's like half the day is gone. Like, because it's just like, he'll just start going. You're like, no, I'm sorry, Malcolm, I got to get you in there. I got to shoot. And he's like, well, one more story, Stephen, you know. And like, but like, he, you know, and that was really a blast to be on set with him. And I think Donald Logue also was the same kind of temperament on set, just real great and funny. And they got along really well.
That's awesome. So I met him once at a convention. It was actually when the original, well, not original, but like Rob Zombie's first Halloween movie. So they got the whole cast together at Monster Mania Con. And it was awesome because, like, you know, he's always a little like with fans. I heard that he's always a little like, I don't know, it takes a little while to warm up. So the icebreaker for me was I had a Mad Magazine Clockwork Orange parody that I had him sign, and he fucking loved it. And then you could like see he was like, oh man, that's so fucking cool. Like, where did you get this? And then that was like a nice kind of icebreaker. But yeah, he seems awesome. So like that's really cool.
I think for guys like that, they just genuinely want to know that. I think they are guarded. Even as a director, when I'm dealing with bigger actors, I mean, of course they're always guarded at first, because they really want to know that you understand the material, you understand what they are all about. Right. And it's not just a superficial sort of, you're great, I've seen you in a ton of movies. Right. Now it's like, you sort of get what their characters are or things like that. Like, you get that magazine and you really, it's like not something that's very typical. And I think that's sort of what I've noticed about movie stars in general when I'm dealing with them, is, you know, in talking to them, I'm not really talking to them about the movie. I don't really talk to them about, this is how I think you should be or your character. I don't get into that nonsense. When I first talk to an actor, we talk about movie. We talked about different life stuff, right? Like, I don't really discuss like what we're going to do until they get to know me and we know each other. And then the movie sort of falls into place and we started talking about how to make the movie. But yeah, I try to find something personal always at first.
Yeah. And that's really smart, because, you know, again, you're like, you know, you have to build and establish that kind of rapport and trust. And I feel like that makes for a really good, like, working relationship. Would you say that, like, you know, some of your bigger actors, you've definitely like kind of learned from them as far as like their process, and then like reverse engineer that to like how you direct them?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, when you're dealing with guys like Bruce Willis or like, you know, Nick Cage, who I've directed, or Stallone, like, yeah, I mean, those guys, especially someone like Stallone, who's also directed, who's, you know, you watch that guy, and you learn from him. And like, you know, but at the same time, you know, a lot of those guys, like what I like to do on their first day, their first actual take, I only do one take. They let them do it and I go, moving on. And it really sort of sets the tone for them, like, right away. They're like, oh shit, like, Steven's not going to sit here, and I better get it right. I better like be on it, because he's going to get it right off the bat. Right. And I think that's sort of like, I sort of try to set the tone of my presence, but then I kind of lean back and let them do their process. And it's really fun to watch, and 100% reverse engineering it, because then I can see, okay, this, the way I talked to him didn't work, but now I know I can talk to this guy a different way. So there's all different kinds of things you take away from these guys.
Yeah, no, that's such a great technique, to, again, sort of establish that you're not like messing around, but then, you know, loosen up a little bit to give them a little bit more
Well, you know, you got to remember, man, they've been making movies for like 30 plus years, right? They've been on every movie set you can possibly imagine. You're no different than whatever they've ever seen. But what they do know is that they don't want to sit there with a director that doesn't know what he wants or doesn't know what he's doing, right? And they don't want to hear you explain the scene. They don't want to hear that. They want to know you understand the movie. You understand that they're going to do their job. And that's what usually that first take rule is for me. It's like, they get right away that I'm not wavering. I get it. You did a great job. You're you. I'm moving on. Yeah, of course, like the next couple of scenes we do, we can do more than one take, of course. But like very upfront, I try to make it very known that like I know what I want, and we're moving on. Even, you know, what's fun is like someone like John Cusack, who I always heard, you know, stories that John wasn't fun or was difficult. And for me, you know, I kind of did a little bit of deep dive on John and realized that, you know, John always wears black. That's like his thing. And the first day I met John, I made sure I wore all black. And I showed up in his trailer and he was like, yo, he looked at me and he's like, dude, we look just like it. We look like each other. And the ice was broken like that, right? And then from that moment on, me and John had we had a great time, you know, and it was amazing. It was fun. So there's little things that I try to do like that. Like I said, that are just, you know, subconscious things to let them know that I'm on the same level or I get it or like, you know, that kind of thing.
Nice. Now, it's kind of interesting because I've noticed in the last couple of years that Silent Night has really found this really awesome cult following. So what's that been like?
It's been unreal. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, when a movie comes out, you're like, this is great. But a lot of the times that's it. It's like it gets us like 3 or 4 months of notoriety and people enjoy it, and then it kind of goes away. I've only had a couple of movies that really stick around and get repeat playability, or I hear about them quite frequently. But Silent Night, just in the past, I don't know, 5 years, has really started to take off on its own sort of trajectory of being a Christmas tradition with horror fans. And so that's been really awesome because I got to be honest, I stepped out of the horror genre for a while, and moved into action. And so I kind of felt like maybe the horror community felt like I dissed them a little bit and like, you know, wasn't maybe in my corner anymore. And so it's been really cool to see Silent Night pick back some steam and really start to become people's must watches on around the holidays.
Yeah, definitely. It was interesting. Right before jumping on, I had a friend who's like a big horror fan, and he like shared his stack of like holiday horror movies, and yours was in there, and I was like,
That's
that's
awesome.
fucking awesome. Yeah. What I like about a lot of your movies is you have this great sense of like dark humor that I think helps it kind of especially Silent Night. I mean, like from jump, you kind of get that tone of like, okay, I know that this is gonna be like cheesy fun, but you're like in on the joke, you know, it's
Totally. Yeah, I think because I grew up like very much into popcorn movies, right? Like I like going to the movie theater. I like the popcorn films. I love indie films. I love when they get very dark and serious. I love that. But as a viewer, I'm more enjoyed things that sort of rode the line of being completely nasty, completely crazy, but at the same time they would throw in things that like are very funny. And you're just like, okay, this is ridiculous. And I think that's just sort of the kind of horror I lean into more. And I think that's sort of like the Return of the Living Dead type stuff, like in the mid 80s that started hitting that really well, that stride of those kind of movies. And those are the kind of movies that really stuck out to me, like The Frighteners, you know, stuff like that, that like I was like, okay, like, you know, these guys are even to me, the Evil Dead movies have that same sort of dark humor and in respect going on sometimes. So I enjoy those kind of movies. It's difficult for me to make movies that people can't stomach to watch. So like I want them to be enjoying themselves, even though there's some pretty gnarly kills. I think the kills are gnarly, but I think they're like cheer kill kind of moments. Like it's like, yeah, they get it. It's not like, oh my God, why? You know, we're not churning the stomach. You know, it's just more like, yeah, they deserve it. We need that, right? And so that's sort of my style, I think, for sure. I'm definitely not the go for hardcore violence for violence sake. It's much more kind of geared towards the story.
Yeah, like it was interesting rewatching it a couple nights ago in preparation for this. I was like, wow, he like full on kills a kid in this in the first like was it 15 minutes or so?
15 minutes, yeah.
But again, a brat, I didn't feel like super bad about it.
Yeah, exactly. I know it's pretty bad when you're like when you don't feel bad about it. You're like, oh man, we should be feeling pretty awful about this situation. And I think that's what got me on one of the first test screenings when that kill happened, when I heard someone go, hell yeah. And I was like, oh shit. Like that's awesome. They're really digging this. So yeah.
Now, so you're a parent now. I'm kind of curious. Obviously they know you make movies. Have they seen any of your horror movies yet, or is it too early?
The only one horror film they've seen of mine is a little one I did called Under the Bed. And it's a monster movie, but it really does deal with more family dynamics and kids. And like, it's a little bit of maybe like Gremlins-esque horror. Where, you know, maybe back in the day Gremlins was PG and now it's not, you know what I mean? But like they've seen that one. Now anything beyond that, my daughter who's gonna be 13 like in next year, she's in that ballpark now where she's like, Dad, you know, I wanna see Silent Night, I wanna see some of this, I wanna see Margot. She really wanted to see Margot. Like Margot was like up there for her, and because of the actors, she knew all of them. And so she was like, I really love these actors and I want to watch it. So I think it's to that point where she's probably going to be watching them in the next year for sure. And really it's not even like, I'm like, no, you can't do it. Like, it's just like, it's difficult when you're like, you got to start to ride that line when you're a parent. It's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think, I don't know about you, but I think I probably watched a bunch of horror movies that I shouldn't have pretty young.
Totally. And to be honest, like I kind of leave that to her friends. like you know what I'm saying, like I kind of leave it up to her, like her cousin or her friend, or like, you know, they give her, they slip her like the Evil Dead and you're like, oh shit, like that's what happened to me, you know. I wasn't expecting it was like I just happened to have older cousins and friends whose parents were like didn't really care what they were doing, and they were showing me movies and I was like, this is awesome, why have I never seen any of this? Now I would go home and be like, Dad, can I rent this? When I was like, hell no, you can't rent that. What are you talking about? You know what I mean? So, you know, it's kind of funny, but yeah, you know, you're right. We definitely were watching things we probably shouldn't have.
Yeah. I vividly recall my older sister. I don't know how she got a hold of it, but a VHS of the original Child's Play.
Oh yeah.
And
crazy.
Yeah. So
how old were you when you saw that? That's got to be like, you're just like, oh shit.
Gosh, I was probably 6 or 7.
Yeah. Young. Yeah. I was one of the first ones I can remember being put on for me was Silver Bullet. And I was probably like 6, maybe something like that. And I remember Silver Bullet and I just was like, what the fuck? Like, and it was just werewolves. I was like, this is banana, you know? And so, yeah, it's just, you know, you can always remember those first ones, but there was a point. Or my dad at one point, I think I was like, you know, a little older, and he was finally like, all right, let's watch The Exorcist. And I was like, oh yeah, let's watch The Exorcist. But yeah, man, having kids makes things a little different. I mean, it does also in sort of like change on how I approach certain things in general too. So yeah, it's interesting.
No, that is interesting, because actually my follow-up was, you know, having kids, does that change your sensibilities as far as like the horror movies you make or just films in general?
Yeah, I think it, you know, it changes like a little bit of, to me, I think the only thing it really changes, and maybe this is just in general, just getting older, is just the nudity factor. Like, mm-hmm. like I didn't really mind shooting nudity. Like it doesn't really bother me. But as I've gotten a little older and then having kids, I feel like, well, I do want my kids to watch this movie. I can be gross, but like the nudity factor of it is like, I don't know if I need it. I don't want to think, you know, especially with my daughter, I don't want her to think her dad is like, you know, being exploitative. You know, I just want her to feel like, you know, dad respects women and that kind of thing too. So it sort of changed a little bit with that respect. But for as far as the horror goes, I don't think, you know, the kill level, I think, is all the same. I'm doing a werewolf movie right now, with Frank Grillo, and my daughter is a werewolf in the movie. Nice. And she like absolutely loved it. And there's some, you know, there's this graphic. And so it's pretty cool.
That's great. You know, have you recently watched Silent Night? And if so, what do you think of it looking back?
I actually just watched it for the first time last week or the week before, and I hadn't watched it since 2012 or 13 when it came out. And I did a couple rounds of screenings and some tour screenings with it in that year. But then I hadn't seen it. And, you know, watching it again, I was really surprised how well it held up. I thought it held up really well. I thought the colors still work really well. Joe White, who was the DP, shot a beautiful movie. I like to tell everybody it's fun because we had to come up with a scheme because the snow ran out. As soon as we started shooting, it stopped snowing. And so when you watch the movie, if you really notice, a lot of my angles are low angle. So it's always looking up at the characters because there's no snow on the ground. I didn't want to show the ground. So I always was looking up because the trees looked right. The sky looked right. And we could have flurries, but it just wasn't on the ground sticking. So, you know, I actually, when I watch it now, it feels like a really cool motif through the movie. And I also think Jamie King's performance is really spot on. I think she nailed it. She is a rad final girl. And she really gave it her all. So yeah, I really enjoyed it though, just watching it back.
Nice. Yeah, it is a fun movie. Like I said, it's definitely in my like must watch. For anybody that wants to see it, it is currently on Shudder, and drop everything you're doing, check it out. Yeah, so this has been a really cool year for, you know, holiday horror movies. Violent Night, Christmas Bloody Christmas, and yeah. The Mean One. Have you seen any of those? And if so, what do you think?
I saw Violent Night last night. I really love Violent Night. I thought that movie was awesome. I like Joe Bagos a lot. So Christmas Bloody Christmas, I went and saw in the theater specifically for Joe. I like his movies. I think he has a very distinct storytelling vibe with every single one of his movies. When I put it on, I know it's a Joe Bagos movie. And so like I like that about him. And I thought Christmas Bloody Christmas was everything you could want with a robotic killer Santa. You know, and so like, you know, I think he did a fantastic job with that movie.
Yeah, I loved it. I got to interview him, which was so cool because I'm such a big fan. Bliss was one of my all-time favorites of that.
Bliss is great.
Yeah.
VFW I like a lot. Yeah, and like, you know, he like I said, he just has a very distinct style. You know it's his movies as soon as you put it on. And he's not scared. He's not scared to put whatever he wants to put on screen. And I like that sort of ballsiness.
Would you ever work with him? Like, would you have like both collab on something?
Yeah, I like Joe. I like his editor a lot. And like I like that their whole sort of group. And yeah, of course, if they were all doing something that they felt like I would be good for, 100%, I would work with those guys.
That would be awesome. I would love to see like a horror anthology with like some amazing like horror directors like you, Joe, like Josh Rubin's another one that I really love.
Yeah, I like Josh too.
But I haven't seen Violent Night yet. Shame on me. I've been holding off because I've been wanting to like find some time to like, you know, watch it in the theater, like on the big screen.
It's like a fun movie. It's fun. I mean, it's pretty hilarious at times too. So, I mean, I thought it was really well done.
Definitely. Like I definitely like David Harbour. I like that concept. Yeah. It's definitely awesome to talk like Silent Night. Like I said, it's a banger. It's really fantastic. Yeah, so like just kind of wrapping up, like what's your like go-to like horror Christmas movie? Is it Silent Night, Deadly Night, or
Silent Night? It is, but really, you know, to be honest, it's Christmas Evil. Christmas Evil, yes, is one that I'll pick up just randomly, and it's usually my Christmas Eve after the kids have gone to bed, and it's me and a bottle of Jack, and it's like I watch Christmas Evil. And Christmas Evil for me was like a movie that I don't know why it hits me hard. It just hits me, and I just really like the movie. I really like what they did with it. It doesn't feel like a typical slasher film at all. And it feels a little more methodical, and I like it.
Oh yeah, I love it. It's I mean, if I was describing it to somebody that's never seen it, I would say it's like Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Meets Twas the Night Before Christmas, and you smash those things together, and
you're exactly right. It has that vibe where you just sort of feel like you're with this character and watching them unravel. And there's something about that like, you know, that was one that I was searching for before Silent Night, which was, does Christmas Evil, is that one ready to be remade? I know I was looking for it. But yeah, it's a really fun movie.
I love how, I think it's one of the only like Christmas horror movies that really kind of nails that sort of isolation and seasonal depression and just alienation that a lot of people, I feel like, unfortunately feel at this time of year.
Yeah, you're right. And it's a real thing, man. You know, and it's one of those things that you have to really think about when you're going through this time of year too, is just sort of remember there are people out there that are having a really hard time. And I think that movie taps into that heavily.
Yeah, and I love that the abusive mom is the wholesome mom on Home Improvement.
Yeah, that's awesome.
yeah, that one I watched the other day while I was wrapping gifts. That's kind of like my go-to while I do that.
Nice.
I think we'll probably wrap it there, but man, it's been so awesome talking to you. People should check out Silent Night on Shudder. I highly recommend Shudder. It's not sponsoring this episode, but god damn it, I love them. So Margot is on Paramount Plus, and so you can watch that if you have that. And it's also like on VOD, so you can like pretty much rent it anywhere.
That's right.
Awesome. And I highly recommend you all do that because it's great. And we're going to demand a Blu-ray, a DVD, a 4K. Yeah.
Set it up.
So hell yeah. Well, hey, thanks again for taking the time to chat with me about Silent Night, Deadly Night, about your Silent Night, which is awesome, and going on some tangents with me. So
no problem, man. I really had fun, Mike. Thanks for having me, dude.
Yeah.